So welcome back to our next session. So this next session will focus on Anabaptist values and practice, how they have shaped my leadership. So in a moment, we're going to hear from two speakers. But first, we'll hear from our student presenter, Jeremy. Jeremy Good is a sophomore at Heston. And he's going to be transferring to EMU to be here with us. So he's an accounting major. He'll be coming over to our business department. And Jeremy is going to speak about why Anabaptist values matter to my generation. So Jeremy, you want to come on up?
Thank you for the introduction. So I'll start off with a brief disclaimer. Like I was introduced, I'm an accounting major. I'm not really that much of a public speaker. That's why I have my laptop here. I have my notes on here. So if you see me looking down, it's because not good with memory, not good with public speaking. So with the help of John Sharp, my classmates, and Michelle Hirschberger as well, I will be presenting on why Anabaptist values matter to my generation. I guess that this goes along with the disclaimer earlier. I'm not a Bible major. This isn't going to be really eloquent. but I don't like speeches that beat around the bush either, and I don't intend to do that. So I hope I'm straight to the point. There are three aspects of characteristics of early Anabaptists that I see modeled in my generation. And I hope that this presentation can be both an affirmation as well as an inspiration to dive deeper into these characteristics as well as our commitments to the gospel of Christ. In 1527, I'm going to give Anabaptist history here. I'm sure most of you could give more history than I can. But in 1527, there are several leaders of a newly found movement called Anabaptism that met in Schleitheim and compiled a confession named the Schleitheim Confession of Faith. As most confessions of faith do, this compilation outlined how the Anabaptists were to interact with each other and the surrounding community. Many confessions of faith have been published since then, including one by Harold Bender, that helped to change the widely held negative opinion of Anabaptism. These confessions of faith there are several ideas and emphasis placed, and like I said, I would like to focus on three of them: nonviolence, community, and being radical. I try to be radical. I feel like I'm a super cool guy, so I'm going to continue. What I'd say is the most stereotypical characteristic of an Anabaptist is the commitment of nonviolent reconciliations. Early Anabaptists demonstrated their abilities in nonviolent resolution, and instead of being another short-lived movement against Christendom, we are a church making its way in the 21st century. As a Mennonite, when someone asks me what my beliefs are centered in, this is usually the second part of my answer. It describes our stance on nonviolence. My generation is a generation that does not have it as hard as other generations before us have had. We are no longer drafted into the military during times of war. We no longer have to register as COs, although I have. Thank you. Not joining the military is not perceived as badly as it once was. Volunteering in alternative service programs can be celebrated publicly. The work we do is not hidden like it was during World War II. Everyone in my generation of the church has the ability to serve in the church rather than in the military, and many do just that. With the chaos of this world spreading quickly, many are leaving this country to serve as peacemakers, not as soldiers. I hear the call for accountability in violent church relationships come from my peers, and I see many who are ready to confront the issue head on. In my own classes, I've heard requests for nonviolent resolution strategies, as many people in my classes haven't been taught them necessarily. We want to be active peacemakers, and we want to show God's love as we make peace with others. With all this being said, being peacemakers is something that's very important to my generation. I think we're a generation that doesn't have a lot of violent actions that are often required of us. We're not required to join the military. So we have this freedom to be peacemakers and be public about it. We, of course, CPS was public, but a lot of the work done was hidden. A lot of the good work was hidden from the public eye, and my generation has the opportunity to do work and have it shown publicly. Although the Schleifheim Confession doesn't specifically say that Anabaptists need to form tightly knit groups in order to be Anabaptists, this is what happened. As more Anabaptist leaders began to get exiled from towns, we see evidence of very strong communities being formed, with worship happening in very, very wonderful places, but very awkward places as well. John, my teacher in Anabaptist history and thought, discusses several meetings on boats to escape the all-seeing eye of the Protestant church, the Catholic church, looking for Anabaptists. This is something we continue today, even though we're not at risk of being burned at the stake as we meet here today. The community still forms. We're a very tight-knit community. And as millennials, this is an aspect of Anabaptism that I believe is particularly important in the coming years. Everyone knows that millennials love social media, but particularly in my friend group at Heston, especially the Mennonite friend group, there's a value placed on the community formed rather than sitting around on Facebook all day, which is something I find wonderful. Being able to worship God together, celebrate grace and mercy that was extended to us, and love each other are vital components of being not just the Mennonite church, but the broader church as well. As my generation moves further into the Mennonite church and into more positions of leadership, I feel like this is something that we're starting to recognize, that millennials can no longer just sit at home and play Game Boy or play Facebook, that we're going to have to step into a community, develop community, worship as a community. As a millennial, I've also become very aware of the negative stigma that surrounds the church because of the tight-knit communities that we form, especially Mennonites on campus at Heston. There's a lot of people that will tell you that it's hard to become friends with all the Mennonite students because they're so tight-knit. So in that aspect, there's something that can be done as millennials to open up the church to others as being part of a community, but not being an exclusive community, being an inclusive community to people who aren't necessarily Mennonite. So I'd say the question presented by this challenge of opening the doors wider for everyone is, how do millennials change this perception of the church? My very simple answer is living in an authentic community, a community where people understand that mistakes are made and where one can live homogeneously, where we don't always play the Mennonite game, where we're not always asking, where are you from and who are you born, or who are you born of? I know it's amazing we can talk about other things. The third aspect of these 15th century Europeans and the Anabaptist values are their radicalness. From the time that I was old enough to hear martyrs' mirror stories from my uncle, it has not yet ceased to amaze me what kinds of torture Anabaptists went through because of their beliefs, because of their radical culture. What's even more amazing is the fact that people were so drawn towards this way of life when many people and families ended up dead because of their culture. So I think that another question that should be asked is, what can the millennial generation do that could turn the kingdom upside down? What can we do as a church that shows that we are not just a close community who cares about its own well-being? What can we do that's radical? I don't necessarily have the answer for any of these questions. Like I said, I'm an accounting student, not a Bible major. I'm not going to give you a big nugget of thought, but I can ask the questions. So ultimately, I think that I could have answered this topic question in two words. They are: Anabaptist values are important to the millennial generation. Perhaps some values that we find in Anabaptism are harder to apply now, but these values and traits are important and they're still relevant to the ever-changing church. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. All right, so next we're going to hear stories from our next two presenters. So the topic is Anabaptist values in practice, how they have shaped my leadership, which I think you'll appreciate some practical kind of applications, especially what we heard about from earlier this morning. So first we're going to hear from Lee Snyder. Lee has served us in Mennonite higher education with administrative positions at EMU in Bluffton. Lee served 12 years as the dean and 10 years as the president of Bluffton University, where she is now president emeritus. And now Lee will be serving as our interim president here at EMU. Phil Wenger will speak after Lee. Phil is the founder and owner of Isaac's Deli in Lancaster. I think it was one of the first to offer benefits, health benefits, to part-time employees. And Phil is a respected leader in the Lancaster community, known for his involvement in philanthropy, especially with Lancaster General Health, which is working to create a better model to deliver care in Lancaster. So I'll welcome Lee to the stage. We'll hear from Lee first.
Thank you, Roxy. She knows I have a thing about podiums that are too high or mics that are up here. Appreciate that. Well, it feels a little heady to address this topic, how Anabaptist values have shaped my leadership. Maybe my story would be better titled, how an unlikely farm girl who was taught to keep quiet ended up as a college president. Let me go back, way back. It was moving day. That night, there would be a farewell dinner at the university, a night of tributes and appreciation by the campus community, as I said farewell after more than a decade in the dean's office. There would be shared memories and much laughter. But on that last day in the office, in the midst of clearing the bookshelves, doing a final sorting of the files, signing a few more certificates, I got a telephone call. This call was a follow-up to a letter I had received shortly before, signed by a group of persons critical of a personnel decision which had been announced. "You are a Christian institution. How can you do this?" was the caller's question. In the months and weeks before, after extensive review, seeking counsel, and admittedly much personal anguish, a decision had been made to ask an employee to relinquish his role. And yes, that decision was ultimately mine. So that morning, I invited the distressed caller to come in, and we sat down over a cup of coffee there in the middle of the moving debris in my office, and I needed to listen. The dilemma was in knowing how much to say to this person who had every right to call us to account as a Christian institution, and how to make myself vulnerable, but also how to remain professional and maintain confidentiality to ensure the dignity of the individual affected by the decision. And that conversation only became more tense after there was a veiled threat of legal action. But the hour spent was necessary for both of us. As leaders of our institutions, we must be clear-eyed about our responsibilities, but also recognize with humility that our work affects people's lives. The decisions we make offer transformative opportunities, such as when we give a promising student a second chance, or we make a hire of a very gifted faculty member. But these decisions inevitably require us to evaluate, to judge, to choose, and yes, to disappoint, and yes, to fire people as well. As Anabaptists, it's sometimes difficult to acknowledge this, that we as leaders exercise power. We are suspicious of power, but we are required to act, to decide. I still wince when I recall one day a blunt exchange with a faculty member This faculty member was very exasperated with the dean, me. "You are not willing to admit you have power," he blurted out accusingly. And he was right. I had a hang-up about power. But back to that final day in the office and the question, how can you do this? You are a Christian institution. I've come to the conclusion that institutions in themselves are not Christian necessarily, but people are. So the way we relate to one another, the way we honor difference, the way we respect, listen, support, and try with all the wisdom we are granted to act responsibly is what leaders must do. And that requires, at times, difficult decisions. I love that prayer, Psalm 19:13, in the contemporary wording, "God, keep us from stupid sins." And as Flannery O'Connor advises, be properly scared and go on doing what you have to do. I grew up in Oregon in a conservative Mennonite congregation where leadership and gender roles were clearly defined, and men spoke for the women. I understand now that in spite of all that, my parents modeled Anabaptist values, which have shaped my own understanding of leadership. First, they honored the faith community. The church was the center of their lives, and they took risks when they felt the call to a mission on Skid Row in Sacramento. They rented out the Ryegrass Farm for a period of time, serving in California without external financial support. Living out their faith daily, being willing to venture into something new, and loving the work taught me much. For me, education was key. After a term of service in Nigeria, I was determined to finish college. And I was lucky because I had a very supportive husband and two daughters who put up with mom in school. Much later, the sheer surprise of finding myself part of an educational enterprise with work I loved still amazes me. Well, it's easy to criticize institutions as inept bureaucracies. Administration is often misunderstood, it is often bumbling, and sometimes it is damaging. But I discovered that I could put up with that when I understood vocation or life work as being part of something larger than oneself. I often return to what Linda Heal of the Harvard Business School offers as three central beliefs that must guide an effective leader. First, she says, we must understand that the institution is more important than any single individual. Two, that the teacher's job, or that the leader's job is to help others succeed, the teachers too. And third, first and foremost, that in making decisions, the organization's future and sustainability must be considered. These are convincing principles. They're straightforward and they seem reasonable. But working them out in daily decisions is complicated. How do we discern what is necessary to be faithful in our God-given responsibilities? Well, we continue to learn, for one thing. For me, those learnings would grow out of specific situations and particular challenges. After all, small colleges thrive only if we are resilient, nimble, and creative. One fall, as school was about to start, we were confronted with a budget shortfall since enrollment was expected to be less than hoped. Anxiety had seeped out over the campus as we got ready for the return of the students. What would this mean? A round of budget cuts, maybe not filling an open position, expanding admissions staff, sending the development folks out to raise more money, what? Well, going to faculty meeting that August, when everyone was on edge about the uncertainty of the new year, one of the senior faculty members spoke up, encouraging colleagues. He said, in a time of being anxious, what can we learn from our Anabaptist people? He reminded all of us that day of the virtues of humility, patience, and not being in control. I continued to learn what leadership was about. One Sunday morning, I had gone to church, specially burdened. I had had a fairly sleepless night, specially burdened with the enormity of a problem facing the college. My management style, if I'm honest, is to cut through the clutter, figure it out, muster support to solve the problem and fix it. No stewing around when something needs to change, and quickly, which of course is often a formula for disaster if it grows out of the needs of the leader. That morning, sitting there in the pew, I felt a little like God reached down and shook me hard. Or maybe the preacher knew more about what I needed than I knew myself. He closed his sermon with these words: "Slow down, shut up, and listen. No need to rush to fix the situation. Don't be afraid to take a risk. Be present. Embrace the moment." God brings new light, he said, when we don't know. Well, one of the most sobering aspects of my own journey, particularly given early influences prescribing gender roles, was the question of how to deal with vocation and calling. It felt presumptuous and prideful to say I feel called to leadership. Here's where Anabaptist values come into play, the discerning community being one of those. Part of that discerning community was the calls that I would get, the community discerning my gifts. But I also saw another aspect of that discerning community when Richard Detweiler, who was trying to persuade me to apply for the deanship here, I was on sabbatical in Oregon, when he assured me that he had consulted with the Lancaster leaders to make sure that a woman dean would be acceptable. So that discerning community worked several ways. The faith community was important in helping me to consider a call, along with wrestling with God in solitude. Times which included books, which would find me at a particular juncture, or certain scriptures, which would directly confront me at turning points. All of these provided signals and signs that I could not escape. On one occasion, when I'd been asked to assume a daunting assignment, a friend who knew me pretty well just asked me outright, "Are you nuts?" Well, maybe I was. But saying yes is part of the deal when it comes to listening to the discernment of the community. Along the way, I was encouraged particularly by the mentors who dared to confess their own questions, who admitted, as one college president described to us novices, to being terrified by the enormity of the president's job. And I often return to the story of the renowned sculptor Henry Moore, who, when asked the secret of his successful life, said, "The secret is to devote your whole life to one ambition, but remember, choose something you cannot do." And he laughed. And I continue to laugh when I think of the way God asks us sometimes to do impossible things. So it is in that spirit of following Christ in whatever unlikely or distressing situation might arise that the leader finds courage for the work. Life work, vocation, is an inevitable blending of certitude and doubt, inexplicable contentment, turbulence, tedium, unpredictability, and paradox. We might quibble about whether one's leadership style is actually shaped by Anabaptist values or whether we're just catching on to some, along with organizational theorists, to the fact that effective and true leadership is plural, not singular. It's about empowering and developing others. What I have realized is that it is my Anabaptist faith that has, in fact, enabled me to embrace a leadership role, a sense of the church's call to service, gratitude for a work of high purpose, taking risks, being willing to face hard realities truthfully, and cultivating relationships, all of which contribute to a vision of hope and possibility. Just a word yet about hope. John Gardner made famous that now familiar saying that the first and last task of a leader is to keep hope alive. How do leaders do that? My teachers have been persons like Thomas Merton, Kathleen Norris, Henry Nouwen, Margaret Wheatley, and Robert Greenleaf. I've been particularly inspired by those who in my reading or who I knew personally have a practical bent and dealt forthrightly with the unwieldiness of organizations. And I think of Erlen Waltner. I wish I would have known Erlen Waltner better, but I think of Erlen Waltner, one of my personal heroes, church statesman and former president of Mennonite Biblical Seminary. Waltner said once, "To abound in hope when so many around me wallow in despair strikes me as a divine calling precisely for such an ominous time as this." As leaders, we are well served today by Erlen Waltner's message of hope. Well, I still have a lot to learn. Perhaps that's why I keep saying yes. but just several observations in conclusion along the lines of some of the practical lessons that I will leave with you. First, the call to leadership always includes an element of not knowing. That is, effective leaders must make peace with uncertainty. Two, leaders must be able to function in a world of complexity and ambiguity. It's not either or, but more often both and. Third, perhaps the hardest lesson for the leader, and here I'm talking to myself, is to learn patience, yielding, waiting, embracing the untidiness of institutions. Fourth, for me, that learning has come through the practices of solitude, prayer, reading, writing, scripture, a practice which steadies and keeps leaders honest and most of the time sane. The habit of solitude is a sacred discipline, one I would recommend. And finally, be open to joy. As one of my board members once advised me when Bluffton University had gotten some unusually good news, enjoy it while you can. Today, I'm inspired and more than hopeful by the way God continues to raise up new leaders, particularly evidenced by this wonderful gathering and by the inspiration to convene. We heard Peter Block talk about convening, the convening community. This convening community gives me hope. May we remain open to surprise and to the nudges that would call us to new things. Thank you.
Hit start on my timer here in case I get wound up. Make sure I don't go over time and say too many things. So this process began for me of coming back to Eastern Mennonite University about 6 months ago when my dear friend Jim Smucker asked me whether I would be willing to come down here and sit on a panel conversation. I thought there would be no preparation involved with that. I thought that would be easy. And because I had graduated from this institution and haven't returned here for the last 35 years, I thought this might be a good way to end up coming back here to begin to interact with folks again. When the program got developed, I discovered that I have to actually speak, okay, which is what I'm going to do with you right now, and that the conference really is something that is quite dynamic, and I'm not even sure how I can play a role and make a contribution. You know, but since I arrived here, I've met my economics professor, I've met my youth group advisor, I've met the attorney who set up the business that I started that's been very successful, and I had an opportunity to walk around this campus, and I continue to have moment after moment of incredible openness and incredible, like, reconnection to something that is very deeply embedded in me. And so what I want to do today is I just want to tell you briefly about that story. That story that shaped me, and then give you the practical lessons, particularly in a business context, of how I believe that influenced me. I have only one really regret, and that's my father, Chester Wanger. He just had a new heart valve, and he is doing strong and going like gangbusters. He's not here to be able to hear me, because I think he would really love to hear the words that I'm going to share with you today. So my story is what I'm going to share with you today. I grew up in Ethiopia. I was the seventh child of a missionary parent who went off to Africa at Ori Miller's great call. My father spent 5 years in CPS, and he was one of those leaders handpicked to go to Africa. Our family read devotions before breakfast, we read devotions before lunch, and we read devotions before dinner. It was Mennonite all the time. I can quote you the tenets of Anabaptism, you know, this idea that you wait to choose to follow Christ and to take up the cross and to follow Jesus. The idea that we are pacifists and that we do not win over our enemies, but we love them. The idea that we have to have a simple life and that we commit ourselves to simple living. And this idea that we are anti-wealth and anti-power, and that we learn that by our interaction with the state, where we need to separate ourselves from the state and be an alternative to the power that gets exercised by the state. When we came back to the United States, I only attended Mennonite institutions. So for 7th and 8th grade, I went to Locust Grove Mennonite School, and then I went to Lancaster Mennonite High. And I remember some very specific experiences from that. At Lancaster Mennonite High, we had a teacher. That teacher wore black every single day. And there was a chalkboard in front of that classroom, and every morning he listened to the news, and he wrote a new number up on that chalkboard. And these were the number of people who had died in the Vietnam War, a war that he thought was so unjust. And in this Anabaptist school, he implanted that on us with his very dramatic presentation of that. In another case, I had a history professor. Many of you might know him, Myron Dietz. And Myron Dietz really taught us Anabaptists from the ground up. But one of the field trips he took us on was driving out into the west end of Lancaster. And there we have a community called the School Lane Hills, and all the houses are $1 million or more. And he taught me what the term blue blood means. These people who inherit wealth, these people who have an entitled sense of society. And he gave me, with great instruction, how Anabaptists rejected wealth and material things because of their corrosive effect and because that just wasn't who we were. In addition to that, I took a mini term. We went up to the Hutterite community in Rifton, New York. So here are these students in their senior year going up there, and we played volleyball, and we played basketball, and we ended up playing baseball, and we did not keep score. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in an athletic activity where you don't keep score? I mean, seriously, I should have recognized that my competitive nature probably wasn't going to be this way, but at that time, that was the model that I thought we all should end up following. So when I came to EMU in 1976, I was a full-blown Anabaptist socialist. I really was. I was opposed to authority. I thought capitalism was at the heart of what was wrong with the world. In fact, it's not much different than Bernie's message today, you know, that wealth is corruption and corruption causes influence and it's a huge negative effect. I edited the Weather Vane. For those of you who are here, I used to wear a MAO hat all the time. It had a red star right up here on top. I went off to Washington, D.C. during the Washington Study Service year. I think you've changed the name of it since then. But the major paper I wrote was on servant leadership, and I became convinced that the only model of Anabaptist leadership I could ever imagine embracing was this idea of a servant leader. So when I came back here to EMU, I rejected the capitalism as a business model, and I used to go around the campus, and no offense, Jim, but I made a lot of fun of the business majors. Because most of the business majors I knew here at EMU were basically going home to run their parents' business, and they were entitled, and they came here to get their business training, and they would end up going back. So I made a decision at that point that I was headed toward one of the careers that persons with my value orientation would probably end up choosing. Many of you in the room have made these choices about your career. I could be a preacher. I could probably be a teacher. I could be a social justice worker. Or I could probably run a nonprofit if I needed to. You know, that would be sort of the route that it was. It just was the career path that I thought I would have. So let's fast forward, okay? Today, I'm sorry to say, but I smoke cigars and I play poker with those same blue bloods whose houses I went and toured in West Lancaster County. In the west end of Lancaster, I own a company. It's got 600 employees. It operates 20 restaurants all over central Pennsylvania. I collect income even though I haven't worked for that company for a number of years. I have two beautiful homes, I have a large art collection, I have five corgis, and I have a husband that I married 2 years ago when gay marriage became legal. But that was after we had dated for 28 years. So what in the world happened to that Eastern Mennonite University student that we had, this Christ-centered socialist who claimed his Anabaptist label with such pride and who viewed business as this evil, you know, empire where there are winners and there are losers. So for this paradigm, I know I'm oversimplifying it for all of you who are really studious and study these kind of things, and with the models that we heard earlier in these presentations. But for me, business was and remains anti-Anabaptist. It uses a completely different orientation. It values wealth, it maximizes power, it takes money from one person and gives it to another. The company that I own, I would guess that 95% of my employees have credit card debt, as an example. And those interest rates all go and pay that money up to people who actually have the resources. And this shift of money all the way up through our capitalist system is happening all the time. And so here I am participating in this anti-Anabaptist business model. Wow, that's pretty heavy if you think about it. If you're a business person and you've got this kind of conscience going on behind the scenes. So what I ended up doing here at Isaac's is I tried to create a different model. I really thought that we might be able to take this other model that says, you know, I will wash your feet, I will give you the shirt off my back, I will not punch you when we are competitors, and so on, would be able to work. So that's where I ended up in that dilemma. So I want to just tell you how I got into that real briefly. 3 years after deciding that I was going to be a preacher, teacher, or a nonprofit leader, I found myself, like many students today, living at home in my parents' basement. I don't know how many of you have gone through that, but that was me. And there was this guy by the name of Isaac. I just tell you how this restaurant chain got started. He graduated from Eastern Mennonite University, too. And he came to me one day. He was living in Lancaster, and he said, there's this little donut shop for sale. Do you think we might be able to start a restaurant together? And I said, well, I've got $10,000 of college debt. You've got $20,000 of college debt. We don't have a nickel to rub together. What might we be able to do? So I went to my dad. Dad was sort of that Mennonite tradition that says, I want to help each child. I'm not going to give them a lot of money, but I'm going to help them a little bit. And so Dad would give each child the down payment on their first house after they got married. Think about me. 1983, I'm not getting married, okay? It's not even in the plan. So I went and I begged my father. I said to my dad, I said, can I have that down payment to start a business? And reluctantly, he agreed. So now I have this business. What the heck am I going to do with it? I want to do it different than everybody else does. I want to see if I could create a platform where we could actually create this culture, a community in business. It's hard work. It's really hard to bring that values orientation into a business context. It's almost impossible. Restaurants are particularly bad. We are notorious for paying low wages. We have employees who have to work and serve us when you guys all want to go out to eat on Friday night or after church on Sunday. They work in a very dangerous environment with hot oil and knives in a very unsafe place. And I call them our modern-day servants because they really, truly are these servants that we don't appreciate. And as a society, we preach against these jobs on a regular basis. You know, we talk about those dead-end burger-flipping jobs that are out there in the community and that we should all go to college and we shouldn't be able to do that. But then we, as consumers, go into those very same restaurants and we complain about the prices and the fact that we have to tip. And so well, that's a topic for another lecture. I'm not going to get into that today. So this either-or meant that we really wanted to try hard at Isaac's. So we did. We offered health insurance for part-time employees, and we still continue to do that today. You know, it used to be in the restaurant business that you didn't offer health insurance unless people worked 40 hours, and then you schedule everybody to work 35 hours so you don't have to provide health care to anybody. Well, we went down and had all these working mothers, and we said, well, we're going to provide health care if you work for us at least 25 hours. We had free food. Okay, you'd be surprised how many people are food insecure who work in our restaurants today. But we had a policy in the first year at my years of my company where we basically said nobody who works in a restaurant should ever, ever be hungry. And so you could eat anything you wanted all the time because that was what I considered an Anabaptist value. We paid people to volunteer, go out and volunteer in the community, you go out and volunteer, you turn in your hours, I'd write a check to your community organization, and we did that, and we still do that to this day. We tried to create this interdependency, and we heard about it this morning a little bit with these circles of caring. And I used to describe the employee pools in our restaurants as more like congregations or communities or like a church, as compared to this other way that businesses tend to treat their employees. This cultural community is embedded in our brand promise. What is our brand promise? What do our consumers expect? And I said that we are going to measure our success by our neighborhood involvement, and we are going to give our time, our food, and our money to benefit others. This both end, as Lee described, as opposed to the either or, either business or Anabaptist life of service, or both end, where we're going to do both, I lived in that tension. And it really seriously took its toll on me. By now, I've built 20 restaurants. The thing is, things have started to change. We now have to have enforcement policies that mean that you fire yourself if you don't do X, Y, and Z. We have to have consistency across the board. We have to have policy variations. We have to have all of these kinds of things. And the tension of doing both end became very challenging. Lee talked about it in dealing with people. That's my single biggest weakness. I can practice Anabaptist values when someone comes to me and tells me that they stole a large sum of money from me, and I can forgive them, and then they stay working with me, which is a true story, and that person was loyal, and we worked together for almost 20 years. But I remember much more clearly all of the examples where I separated somebody's employment for reasons that were either their fault or were the organization's fault, and we ended up having people lose their income and separating from that. I remember a young woman who was carrying a pot of hot chicken soup, has the oil on top, and she's walking, and she slips. And that hot soup is poured down over her bosom, and she gets all kinds of burns across her breasts. And she has to go in, and obviously workers' compensation pays for that, but then nobody would pay the plastic surgery bill to rebuild her breasts, who were severely scarred. And this was a young woman who wasn't married, who was probably only 19 years old. And I just remember the tension and the challenges that I had in my values orientation. And so this idea that we can do this together, that we can operate with Anabaptist values in business, really, really took its toll. Because in this wage, you know, we talk about wages. I'd love to pay everybody $15 an hour. But everybody else in the restaurant business, those places that you go eat at, those chains here and those independent restaurants, are all paying, you know, minimum wage. And so how can you afford to attract those customers to be able to do something different? So this tension of Anabaptist values and running a business finally got to me. I fired myself. I literally did. I couldn't live in that both end. I really couldn't. And this is sort of the confession I have coming to you today. I took a couple of years off. I worked with my hands. I renovated a shack along the fishing, you know, along the Susquehanna River. But I realized I wasn't done with leadership. And so today, I mean, I have absolutely, no offense to Jim and all of you who want to go out and start businesses to solve all the problems of the world, I have zero desire to go back into business. So I decided to do that other career that I talked about, which is I'm going into land conservation, and I'm now the CEO of the Lancaster County Conservancy. And I'm going out and identifying beautiful tracts of God's creation, and I'm using the influence and power I have with a lot of these people, and I'm pulling the money together, and we're going and saving this land for all of our future generations. And I've become sort of this raging environmentalist as I learn all about conservation and practices, and I'm having more fun now than I ever did. So I am now a nonprofit leader begging for money, which is why just want you to understand this. I'm still playing poker and smoking cigars with those folks down at the Hamilton Club. They're all learning that I've got a desire to get into their wallet, and they've made this resources, and they want to do that. So anyway, this was my aha moment in preparing these comments, that that's really where this journey is taking me. I don't know where this is going to end. The story, the rest of my story hasn't been written. I don't know what the future holds or what the final chapters of my life are going to be. Will I sell all my things and give everything away and live that life of simplicity I yearn for? I have a spouse to contend with on that issue. I don't know the answer to that. But I'm here basically to say it's not easy to be an Anabaptist and a business leader exercising power. In fact, I remain convinced after this life's journey that I shared with you today that it is almost impossible to do both and. So, thank you. This is my experience through my lens, and I hope it gives you some fodder or some things to talk about. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, we're very grateful to Jeremy and to Lee, and also to you, Phil, for those incredible stories of how values have shaped your leadership practice and are shaping your future leadership. We are focused on values this session, and we wanted to put you into circles to talk about values. We had decided to do this even before Peter Block's talk, just so you know. But I'm going to suggest that the circles be 3 to 5, because that's an ideal size, and that you might want to consider the following question. We're going to frame the question and then give you a moment to sit in silence about it and then gather. And the question would be, is there a time in my leadership journey, in my life, when I've had to make a decision, a very difficult decision, but explicitly calling on my own values? And if you're comfortable, is there a time in my life, looking back, when I made a decision that violated my own values, and this is what I learned from that experience? But we'd love to give you time to hear life stories from all of you in that circle. Realistically, we're going to suggest about 20, maybe 25 minutes for you to meet in circles. So if there are 3 to 5 of you, each of you would have about 5 minutes, and that should be enough to at least share a time when your values shaped a decision, an important decision. It could be regarding marriage, it could be regarding career, it could be regarding something in the church that you'd be willing to share with others. So let's just take a moment to reflect on that in silence, and then I'll ask you to gather your chairs. The question again is, how can I share a time when my values, Anabaptist or other, shaped a decision that I needed to make? And if you'd now gather in groups of 3 to 5, hopefully include a stranger, as Peter suggested, somebody that you don't normally sit with in that group of 3 to 5. And we'll check in with you in 20 minutes and see if you need more time. So this was a group that was eager to talk with each other. We're so glad you engaged that. That actually was about 30 minutes of engagement and very rich. We also had a conversation up here. We're not going to invite Q&A, but we would be interested in hearing if there was a theme or an insight from your group that you'd be willing to share with the larger group. We will take about 5 minutes to get those comments and then have some closing comments before we wrap up. So not so much a Q&A session, but was there something about values, ethics, dilemmas for leaders that struck you and you could share, without identifying details, but a theme that came out of your group discussion? And as you're thinking, I'll share one from our group which really struck me. And one is the dilemmas of when we're not choosing between right versus wrong, but right versus right, when there are two important principles at stake. For example, justice and inclusion and financial viability, and how do you, as an organizational leader, balance those two things as you're moving forward. And the other was the reality, and I'll tell this as a story. I was doing a STAR training once on leadership, and I said, well, can you just brainstorm some words that come to mind when I say the word leadership? Or leaders. And people said, well, leaders plan for the future. Leaders make up budgets. Leaders manage people and projects. And then there was a pause, and someone said, leaders suffer. And that's part of what I got from the sharing here, is that the reality is when you're dealing with people you love and organizations you love, and it's right versus right, leaders suffer.
One of the tensions that came out in our group was small. I had only three, but all three of us had the tension. It was one that Lee mentioned in her conversation, too. Between what we deeply are committed to as individuals and what we hold to be the way of Jesus and the life-giving way, and what the institutions are demanding of us, and what our role is, on the one hand, in transforming the institution versus stepping out of it. And so I could elaborate on that, but it has to do versus the power of the institution and whether we give that institution priority over our own integrity. Enough said, maybe.
That dilemma between when it's time to step out because one cannot tolerate the injustice or whatever it is, and when it's time to stay and continue to advocate for that. Other themes that came out of your group discussion?
Where a lot of this hits the fan is in when you go to fire somebody, or when your organization or your group or your church decides that somebody needs to go, that you can't bear the cost anymore of dealing with them. That's the big stressor in many organizational and business settings. And the conceit is that we should somehow be able to heal the situation, heal this person, so that they can participate in the group well, positively, wholly. But we often just lack the ability to do that, and so after we crash and burn after having spent enormous resources on the problem. Maybe we ought to be more strategic about that and invest an educational institution in trying to make a science of healing. Maybe there is something to that dream, but it will take a lot more investment than we've been able to do.
The inherent tension sometimes between justice and mercy in terms of how we respond to individuals, particularly those that might cross boundaries in some way. Anything else before we wrap up this session?
Our conversation went in a similar direction to the last gentleman who spoke. And one of the I'm Mary, and our conversation went a similar direction about working with personnel and when it comes to firing. And I would wonder if some of the challenge is the way we define our values, and that they mean that restoration or reconciliation means a certain thing, rather than an action opening a pathway to reconciliation that takes into account the common good as well as the needs of the individual. And it may not feel like justice or mercy at the moment, but it's holding that tension.
Reminds me of something an experienced mediator told me when I was 28 years old and a new mediator. He said, "Dave, you have to beware the rush to reconcile." That's what I'm hearing from you. So we are going to invite our artist in residence, Janine, to briefly describe what's evolving for her. If you were here last night or first thing this morning, you heard us talk about her role in charting visually some of the things that we're talking about verbally. So what would you say so far?
I'll just give a brief overview, taking into account last night. Starting off with this painting here behind, of starting from a history which is now annotated in books with different perspectives. So some pages face one way and some the other. And also thinking of our biblical foundation. And then as those pages take flight into the reality of the community that sits here now and will sit into the future. And as that leaves the page, and also those then become a page later on. And the second painting then is this one, speaking of community and how that community is built. And here they are bodies building a tree, building a community, and also bodies that are somewhat bird-like. So sticking with our theme of a moving community. And then also taking into account some of yesterday's conversation about sustainability and are we thinking about our environment and our consequences. And then also the strength. This figure is very strong. This figure is very strong. But then the gentleness of some of the other figures and considering all aspects of our community and how that holds together and grows together. So that for now.
And I'm going to suggest that everyone stand because you've been sitting for a while. And Lee will lead us in a closing prayer.
Creator God, we come to you with thanksgiving for your grace to us today for this conference. We ask now that you would guide our conversations, continue to bless our meetings, and we thank you for the food and the fellowship that we are going to experience. Through Christ we pray, amen.